Hello? Hello? Can you hear me? Yep. Yeah, now you can. Okay, I got it.
Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. That's Greg Bernstein, who we'll be talking to in just a moment.
Sorry about that, Mark.
That's all right, Greg. But first, we start off with our day in history on this day, September the 3rd. This is the day when Charles Hamilton Houston was born, September 3rd, 1895. He was a very important lawyer in our country, dean of the Howard University Law School, head of the NAACP litigation director. He was called by many the man who killed Jim Crow. He's also the man who taught and partnered with Justice Thurgood Marshall, one of the leading lights in law in America, who died in 1950. And today is his birthday. Also the birthday in 1914 of the great Memphis Slim, pianist, composer, singer, the blues man from the South. And Marguerite Higgins was born on this day in 1921. And who was she? She was the woman who went off and became the first major female war correspondent and then wanted to do battle for equal rights for women, covering wars around the world. It's an amazing, brave, and incredible reporter to boot. This is the day that Whitey Bulger was born. I guess he regrets that in some ways today because he's gone away for quite some time in 1929. Freddie King, the baby brother of BB, was born on this day in 1934. And this is the day that Oliver Cromwell died in 1658, the Roundheads, British Civil War. This is also the day in 1962, the great poet, one of my first favorite poets as a young kid, E.E. Cummings was born, died. Vince Lombardi died on this day, the great football coach. And this is the day that William Rehnquist, former Chief Justice, died in 2005. An interesting juxtaposition. In 1777, the Revolutionary War was being fought. The first day the American flag was flown. This is also the day in 1783 that the war officially ended with the Treaty of Paris. And it's the day in 1838 that Frederick Douglass, disguised as a sailor, escaped from slavery on the Eastern Shore and made his way to Baltimore. This is the day that in 1868, during Reconstruction, huge battles took place. In 1868, a former slave, Henry McNeil Turner, delivered a speech before the Georgia legislature saying African Americans had a right to hold state office. That same day in 1868, the lower house of the Georgia legislature threw out and expelled 28 black representatives from that house, and then three from the Senate the next day. And Congress refused to admit the state into the legislature until it seated the black representatives. This was the beginning of the battle to destroy Reconstruction in the South. It was a pitched battle. This is the day in 1891. There was an organization of the Union, American Farmers Union, cotton pickers, were about to strike across all of the southern states in America, from Texas to North Carolina. But they were beaten. They tried to escape, were mowed down in the Mississippi by the Mississippi River. It was a huge piece of history that we never talk about. This is also the day in 1919 that Lincoln Motion Picture Company, owned by two African Americans, Noble Johnson and Clarence Brooks, made their first feature-length film. If you haven't seen it, you should see it. It's fascinating to watch. It's called A Man's Duty. And this is a day in 1944 when Anne Frank and her family were placed in the last transport train to take them to Auschwitz, where they were killed in concentration camps. And this is the day that Jonathan Rogers became the highest-ranking African-American ever to hold the position of president of CBS's television division. That happened in 1990. So, in short, that's this day in history, September the 3rd. So, welcome, Greg Bernstein.
Good morning, Mark. Thanks for having me, as always.
And, folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages, and I'll see what you have written there. Or you can tweet us at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. We called in droves the other day when we were having conversations with the Anderson and West families. This is your day to talk to the state's attorney, 410-319-8888, and we'll come to your calls in just a few minutes. So, Greg, there's been this huge spate of murders and shootings in the city. And it seems in some ways that our public justice system, police, state's attorney's office, is kind of in a haze is too strong a word, perhaps, but in a quandary about how to attack the issue, how to get a handle on this, even why it's happening. You hear from some people are saying it's happening because of drug war. Others are saying it's much more insidious and deeper than that.
Well, I don't view it as a quandary. I view it as a very, very difficult issue that we have to address. This is hard stuff, and Baltimore has faced waves of crime in the past. And it's one of the reasons that I ran for state's attorney, because I felt that at least with respect to my role in prosecuting people, that we could really make a difference. And I think that we've made some great progress in the state's attorney's office, which I'm happy to talk about later. I think, Mark, though, to answer your question more directly, I think that, as I have said all along, that the focus needs to be on investigating and successfully prosecuting the repeat violent offenders in our city who are responsible for a disproportionate amount of the violence that occurs. The data all establishes that if we can be strategic and focused on that core group of individuals, I think we can really start to make a difference. And that requires not only the assistance and the efforts of the state's attorney's office, but it requires all of the efforts of the mayor's office, the Baltimore City Police Department, and the community. And I think we all have a role to play, and we all need to work together to try to combat that violence. I can say that at least in terms of what I'm doing in the state's attorney's office and my work with the police department and the mayor's office, we are in sync. We are working together to develop the kind of strategies that I've been talking about to focus on these individuals.
One of the things that when you saw that huge Sun Papers piece that that Justin Fenton did, and which I thought was a pretty interesting set of interviews they did around violence in Baltimore, the sense you get is there's a lot of people are not testifying because the witness protection in this city seems not to be working, that people are afraid to testify. There's been a lot of critique from people saying that there's just no protection for folks to come out and say what they've seen because there's no way to protect the folks who would testify.
Yes, and that is really kind of a two-part issue. Certainly, witness intimidation has been a factor that has made it difficult for us to prosecute these cases long before I became state's attorney. I mean, it's always been an issue in Baltimore. I think that, number one, you have the issue of trust vis-a-vis the relationship between the community and law enforcement. It's difficult when there's a homicide, for example, and the homicide detectives are out at the scene and there are, you know, 20, 30 people standing around. It's pretty clear that there's been any number of witnesses. But yet no one is really coming forward. As hard as they try, I mean, the homicide detectives work extremely hard to try to develop witnesses and try to get people to come forward. And I think that in one respect, it's a function of mistrust. The second piece, though, is that for some folks, there is a concern or a fear, if you will, that there will be some type of retaliation. I can tell you that in the state's attorney's office, we work very hard to provide protection to our witnesses. We have a very established program that we're constantly working on and improving. We work closely with the police department. We quickly identify cases in which there might be any even hint of intimidation. We have protocols in place to meet and talk to witnesses to ascertain the nature and extent of the threat, as does the police department. They do a great job, too. We have temporary housing arrangements where necessary and even permanent placement where appropriate.
So now, I'm going to get these phone calls coming in here and some emails, 410-319-8888. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. Facebook, and there was a comment on Facebook saying that maybe they say it would, I'll pull it up in a minute, but the gist of it was, from somebody named Marilyn, was that the state's attorney's office doesn't appropriate the right amount of funds to protect witnesses, and called into question moving to a downtown office and how many millions did that cost as opposed to putting money into both prosecution and also into protecting witnesses who could come forth. Now, what's the connection between what people are criticizing you in terms of moving to, which you did, move to corporate offices, that some people are arguing cost $11 million that could have been used more appropriately for prosecuting criminals and protecting witnesses.
Right. I mean, that's obviously the person that raised that question doesn't really understand, you know, how our budget process works and where the funding comes from. It's a somewhat naive understanding of the system. First, with respect to the issue of the move from the courthouse to the new office space that we've been able to accomplish, which I am extremely proud of. It has, Mark, it has literally created a sea change in morale, in effectiveness, in efficiency, in the way in which the state's attorney's office operates. The improvement and the attitudes of the folks is really palatable when you walk around the halls to see how improved it is. We were operating under really kind of horrific conditions in the two courthouses where the state's attorney's office had been since the Mitchell Courthouse was built in 1910. And when the Mitchell Courthouse was built in 1910, there was, what, 3, 4, 5 state's attorneys. Now there's over 200. We have an office of 400 people. So as the office grew, we were kind of pushed into nooks and crannies throughout the courthouses, the two of them, so that there was no continuity. It was really very disjointed. The different divisions were almost like individual fiefdoms. There was, in order to meet with folks, you had to walk through the halls. You had to kind of bump into witnesses, defendants, court personnel. It wasn't a true office. And everyone, and I mean everyone, who has even the slightest connection to the Mitchell Courthouse and Courthouse East recognizes the problems with those two structures, with the physical issues. It is just they are not in great shape, to be mild about it. And in fact, Mark, just last week, Chief Judge Holland, who's the administrative judge of the court, has been working tirelessly for the last few years to try to get funding to build new courthouses. And she's now enlisted the assistance of a number of prominent attorneys in the city to try to go to the governor to try to get funding to conduct a study. So the notion that this was not necessary and this is not is just belied by reality. Let me just
finish the question. Was it $11 million and where did the money come from?
I'm getting to that.
Okay, but
Mark, I'm getting to that. Now, with respect to the funding, it really, frankly, is even borders on disingenuous to say that it's $11 million. The fact of the matter is it's a lease, and we pay X number of dollars every year under the terms of the lease. It's not as if someone wrote a check for $11 million and said, here, go spend it. The other thing to keep in mind is that the money came independent of our budget because we were in the courthouse, and because we were in the courthouse, we were there rent-free. So in order to accomplish this, and for all the reasons that I described earlier, I had to go to folks outside of the budget process to try to get the funding to pay for the lease. And the governor has stepped up. Half the money each year for the rent comes from the state. Comes from the General Assembly. It comes from the state legislature. It comes from the money. It's money that's earmarked for that purpose. The other half of the funding comes from the mayor's office. And so to say that the funds are fungible, so to speak, that you can just take the money and spend it as you would, is just wrong. And in fact, was directed for that specific purpose. And finally, I would say that a large portion of our budget is focused on witness protection. We have many people in our office that are responsible for that purpose. We have funds available to house them as necessary.
So what is the $11 million number? Is that what you pay a year? Is that the lease?
Oh, my gosh, no.
What is it?
The lease is for, I think, about 10 years. The lease is a 10-year lease, and the rent, I think, is a little over $1 million a year. And that $1 million each year, Mark, comes from half the state and half from the city. It's additional funding that the governor, that the General Assembly, that the members of the Budget Committee, that the mayor of the city, that the members of the city council all believed was well spent, was money that was necessary and important for the state's attorney's office to improve its efficiency and its effectiveness.
Let's go to the phones. 410-319-8888 is the number here. We're here with State's Attorney Greg Bernstein. We have a lot of questions left and a lot of time left. So join us at 410-319-8888. Jason, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning, Jason. Welcome.
Good morning. Mr. Bernstein, this is Mr. Rodriguez, and we talked about this before. You know, for some reason you refuse to prosecute officers, even though the evidence is clearly laid out for you. I expressed to you that in my particular case, Judge Littman in Southern District Court said that the officers had violated our constitutional rights, but yet you still refuse to move on these type of matters. I happened to be down this morning at the Anthony Anderson's family this morning. They were facing an eviction this morning. This family is upset and disturbed by the behavior of the state's attorney's office, along with several other families like the West family, who is upset at the behavior and the lack of accountability, the lack of transparency, the lack of openness within your administration. I don't know what it's going to take for you to understand that we have a problem with some of our officers. And until we start setting examples by holding them accountable for their actions, the behavior from the police department will continue to prey and will continue to violate people's rights in the streets. And we're asking that you act on this and put a stop to this. All you need to do is just prosecute a few officers, and the other officers will get the point, will get the message that you can't come out here and violate the rights of the citizens of Baltimore City. When are you going to act, sir? When are you going to act? When are you going to hold just one officer accountable?
Okay, so, Mr. Rodriguez, it's good to hear from you. For the rest of the listeners, you should know that Mr. Rodriguez and I have had a number of really frank conversations with each other over the last few months at various meetings and the like, and I really appreciate his views, and we've had some great discussions. First, with respect to his personal situation, he well knows that he is represented by counsel who I've made numerous efforts to reach, but for whatever reason his lawyer hasn't contacted me, and I'm happy to talk to his counsel whenever he wants to get back to me. More broadly, with respect to the specific cases that he has mentioned, the Anthony Anderson matter, which happened last October, it was what we call an in-custody death, in which an individual died while in police custody. As most of your listeners know, we conducted a very, very thorough, a very extensive investigation in that case. We were completely transparent. We were completely open. When we completed our investigation, we held a lengthy press conference in which we laid out in, frankly, excruciating detail the basis for our decision, why we felt that it did not warrant criminal charges. I mean, whether there's civil liability, that's a completely different issue. But, and with respect to the West case that he mentions, that, of course, is an open, ongoing investigation.
Involving some of the same unit, some of the same officers.
No, not the same officers. No, absolutely not. They're different officers. But
same unit.
I don't know if that's right either, frankly. I don't think so. As a matter of fact, I don't think that's true.
Okay.
But at any rate, in fact, I know it's not true. But at any rate, that's an open investigation that is, you know, we're still pursuing. And, you know, this isn't something that I tout, right? This isn't something that I take great pride in because it's an unfortunate but necessary part of my job. But we have prosecuted a number of police officers since I became state's attorney. We've unfortunately had to prosecute officers for assault, for excessive force, for making false statements. So there's, again, unfortunately, it's not something I take pride in, and certainly not something that the commissioner takes pride in because he and I talk about these issues all the time. Commissioner Batts is working very hard to prevent any officer in the Baltimore Police Department from violating any law. But notwithstanding that, like any organization, there's always going to be a few people that are going to violate the law. And we've prosecuted them. So the notion that we haven't is just not true.
But I think people are still – let me get a call in here, then I'll come back.
Sure.
I have some questions about that because I think the shows we've done in the last several weeks on these issues, there are too many unanswered questions about some of these deaths. And I mean, we did intensive conversations about Anthony Anderson on the show with you and others when that happened. 410-319-8888. Join the conversation. We want to hear your viewpoints, your questions for Greg Bernstein. Bruce, you're on the air. Hi, Bruce. You're there.
Yeah. The last guy kind of set up the segue that I was going to get into. It was really ridiculous that nobody in the status quo, nobody in the command structure of the police department, the mayor doesn't want to admit it, that there has to be a better-funded independent civilian review board. It's been underfunded and undermanned for decades. That's a dirty little secret. Unless you have an independent civilian review board that acts independent of the police department, the way it works now is they gather facts and information and make recommendations to the police commissioner, which is wrong. They have to be independent. They have to have more legal power. They have to be. I honestly think they should be able to bring indictments and subpoena more subpoenas for better oversight of the police department. And it's not just them harassing. It's just everyday stupid things, the way they disrespect people, all the corruption's been involved in the last 5 to 10 years with the police department, improper police reports. I could go on and on and on. Independent civilian review board with real teeth.
That is, thank you, Bruce. That is a thing we've talked about here on the show before. I mean, that some people would argue on two levels here. I mean, A, that the state's attorney's office is too close to the police department to kind of get the prosecutions done that are needed, and that you do need an independent review board to review these cases that come up, a civilian review board, which in this city exists, but it has no teeth. It is nothing. It's just a piece of paper. I don't think they even met in the last several years. Because there are constant cases of officers mistreating the public, nothing ever seems to get done.
A number of cities around the country have civilian review boards like the ones that Bruce was talking about. None have, that I'm aware of, actual prosecution power. But I think Bruce makes the good point that there are any number of instances where police officers have encounters with citizens that don't rise nearly to the level of warranting criminal prosecution, but maybe, you know, violated some administrative rule and the like. And in those situations, that's really what I think a civilian review board is designed to do, is to kind of ferret that stuff out, make recommendations and the like.
Well, I'm going to take a break and come right back. Tyrone, others are calling in, 410-319-8888. We'll go to Tyrone as soon as we come back. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner with Greg Bernstein here in the Mark Steiner Show. Our state's attorney, 410-319-8888, is the number here. Let's go to Tyrone. You're the next caller up. Tyrone, you're on the air.
Yes, hello.
You're on the air, Tyrone. Welcome.
I'm not sure if this is even current now, but I think the police should have cameras on their cars as a minimum. And we have the technology. I think they should have cameras on their uniforms, if at all possible, and as well as microphones, because I know that would definitely cut down on a lot of this inaccurate reporting and the complaints against police have been so numerous. I think this is warranted at this point in time, and it would definitely cut down illegal police procedures and practices. So, I mean, I think we should look into that as a remedy to some of the problems that we face with the police department. It's not like being killed unjustly or imprisoned unjustly based on shoddy police work. I'm not saying all police are bad, but the ones that are need to be punished. Thank you.
Right. Well, Tyrone, first of all, yes, we could hear you loud and clear, and thanks for your call. And I certainly, there are a number of departments throughout the country that use that kind of technology. I know that I don't know that Commissioner Batts is studying that particular option, but, you know, he is. I do know that he spends a lot of his time trying to develop policies and strategies to make the department not only more effective but more transparent. I think transparency is very important to Commissioner Batts. I don't want to speak for him. So I think that's a great suggestion and one I'm sure that he's considering.
But do you think that should happen?
You know, I tell you, Mark, it's not I'm not trying to duck the question. It's just not really for me to say. I mean, I think that There's a host of issues that are associated with that in terms of, you know, where's the money come from, and you got to get the technology, and you've got to train the officers, and that kind of thing. And it's, you know, it's not really for me to make a judgment about what is an appropriate mechanism for that kind of transparency.
Let me ask you this, the question before we go to the next caller. Shorty, and also an email here from Jackie. 410-319-8888 is the number here. During the break, we got into a little thing here for a moment over the way a question was asked earlier in the show around Anthony Anderson and around my supposition it was the same squad or the same officer. You said no, it wasn't. That came up on the show the other day where it was raised that they were the same, some of the same officers were involved, and that they were, it's the same unit. If those folks were wrong, then they're wrong. And I don't have the facts, so I'm going to throw that out. But two, I mean, so what is the definition then of excessive force? Picking up a guy, slamming on the ground, is that excessive force or not? Is it, you know, when you had the witnesses in the Tyrone West thing, we have a number of police officers gathering around, beating and kicking a man. Is that excessive force? What is excessive force?
Well, let's break it down. I mean, there are two different cases. But with respect to the Anthony Anderson matter, the way that police officers are trained, actually this would apply, frankly, to both cases. The way that police officers are trained regarding their use of force is there is a continuum that based on the response that they receive from the suspect determines the degree of force that they are authorized to use to address that situation. So taking the two extremes, I mean, obviously, if I'm a police officer and I see you on a street corner and I think you're engaged in some kind of suspicious behavior, and I walk up to you and I say, sir, can I talk to you for a moment? And you turn around and you say, well, sure. Well, obviously, there's no authorization or justification for me to use any kind of force in that situation, right? The other end of the extreme would be if I said, sir, you know, can I talk to you for a minute? And you turned around, pulled a gun out, and started shooting at me. Well, then, of course, I'm authorized to use deadly force. So the other scenarios, so to speak, all kind of fall in between. So in the Anthony Anderson case, you have a situation in which the officers observe what they believe to be a drug transaction take place, that they pull up on the corner or on the side of the street after the two individuals split and walk apart quickly when they realize that the officers are approaching. The one officer gets out of the back seat of the car, identifies himself, asks the individual, Mr. Anderson, who's now walking quickly away, to stop. Mr. Anderson looks over his shoulder, doesn't stop, and just keeps walking away, ignores the officer's command. And at that point, they observe Mr. Anderson taking something out of his pocket and start to put it into his mouth, which later, of course, turned out to be a baggie containing narcotics. The officers didn't know that at that point, but given what they had observed during the drug – what they believed to be the drug transaction, Mr. Anderson refusing the instruction to stop, and then seeing him reach into his pocket and put the baggie into his mouth, they believed he was now trying to secrete or destroy contraband. So at that point, what the officer does is he runs up behind him. He gets him in a bear hug. He picks him up off the ground. Now, depending on which of the witnesses you spoke to, and we interviewed all of them, including family members, you know, some people say he pretty much tackled him to the ground. Other people say he lifted him up way in the air. And then there's other witnesses who say kind of in between. But the officer does that in order, A, to stop him, and to B, to prevent him from continuing to ingests the contraband, takes him down to the ground. And that's the sum and substance of the force that was used. Now, unfortunately and very sadly, Mr. Anderson, the autopsy indicated, had an enlarged spleen, which made him more susceptible to the bleeding. And so in that situation, we concluded that based on the training and the use of force continuum that I described, that was not excessive force to the extent that it warranted criminal prosecution. Now, with respect to the West case, that is an ongoing investigation in the true sense of the word. I mean, we are actively involved in that. So it really, I think, would be premature to make any kind of judgments or any kind of observations about what kind of force, if any, that was used that resulted in Mr. West's death.
There was a former officer on the show not long ago who said that that you know when we chase, if somebody, if we have to chase somebody, the word's out. If we catch them, we're gonna hit them. And that's just part of what police do. That's what they said on the show. As former officers, the question is, what is excessive force? I mean, when you see over and over cases in the city where police kind of overstep, pushing people, throwing people around, hitting people. I mean, what is excessive force, and how do we bridge that gap so that the policing community actually cooperate instead of becoming antagonistic? Because there is excessive force all the time. I see it on the street. We all see it on the street. How do you define it? What do you do about it?
Right. So, well, let me say two things about that. First, I mean, I think I have defined it in talking about the situation with Mr. West. I'm sorry, Mr. Anderson. But second, more broadly, you know, not. Well, that's the best way to describe this. You know, certainly when an individual dies in police custody, that is a tragedy, no matter what the circumstances. I mean, even if the individual, you know, I mean, look, take the horrible case in Bulmer County with Officer Schneider. You know,
he was murdered.
He was killed. Yeah. You know, and the suspect turned and fired at him. And you know, and he, Officer Schneider, is a hero, and his death was a tragedy. You know, but anytime somebody dies in that kind of situation, it's just tragic. So we tend to focus on those kinds of cases. But to your point, certainly there are a whole range of cases where an officer may, you know, use more force than is necessary under the circumstances. And when they do, Mark, we prosecute those cases. I mean, we have prosecuted officers who, after, you know, an individual submits and doesn't, you know, attempt to flee or run, and the officer strikes him or knocks him to the ground or tries to beat him up, we've had to prosecute some of those cases. So to your point, we do take it very seriously. And the proof, as they say, is in the pudding. I mean, we do prosecute those officers when the situation warrants it.
Let me just pull this right here so I can watch you and the computer at the same time. Jackie writes in, and we're going to go to Shorty, Ernest, and Frankman to get to your three calls. Jackie writes in, how will you change the practice of your office of treating victims of violent crime and witnesses of crime as criminals? There are witnesses to gun violence who legitimately are terrified to testify. Just last week, a woman was asked to testify as a witness in a gang-related murder. She had no police protection, no support from the witness protection program, was completely exposed to retaliation, and even risk incarceration if she doesn't show in court.
Well, obviously, I can't comment on that specific example because I'm not sure which case Jackie is referring to. But what I can tell you, Mark, as I indicated earlier, you know, we view the protection of our witnesses with the utmost seriousness. It is one of the, you know, main objectives of our office because, look, think about it for a moment. We're not going to be successful in prosecuting our cases if we don't have witnesses who are willing and able to come forward. So it's certainly in our best interest to do everything we can to protect them. And as I said before, there's always, of course, room for improvement. We're always trying to do better. But I think we have a very good system in place where, as I mentioned before, working with the police department, we identify the threat, we determine its assessment, and then we take action where appropriate.
Let's get the phones. A lot of people calling in and get people have their say at 410-319-8888. Shorty, you're on the air.
Catch me before I can say something, huh?
Shorty, you're on the air.
Yeah, this is Shorty.
You're on the air.
All right. I'm asking Bernstein directly, all right? He know me personally, all right? I was making a documentary about the judicial system, and you're denying us access to the court, but you can, in your same breath, as a state's attorney, use prosecutorial discretion to administer Jim Crow justice in your justice system. You're supposed to give us access to the grand jury. You locked me up for putting a toilet in the toilet represented a movie I was making about you, Schellenberger, Judge Turnbull, Governor O'Malley, and the Democratic Party in the 2010 election. You won't talk to me, you won't answer the subpoenas, and you keep blocking anything that goes to the court. So how is it that you're doing the people's will when you're doing the corporations and protecting the politicians? This is me and you, Bernstein. This ain't no out-of-the-way conversation. This is me, Shorty Davis, and Bernstein talking. On February the 2nd,
okay, I gave you a whiff. Let me let him respond, Shorty.
I'm not really sure how to respond. I don't really have a response. I'm sorry.
What was he? Is he asking you that there's no communication, that you've been subpoenaed and haven't shown up? Is that what he's saying to you?
I'm really not sure, Mark.
You haven't been subpoenaed.
No.
Shorty, hold on a second. We'll come right back so we can get some more clarity. But let me go to some other callers. Just hold on. 410-319-8888. Ernest, you're on the air. Ernest, you're on the air.
Yeah, good morning to you and your guests.
Good morning.
I think that police departments, especially when you have a police department, that when they have contact, it's a lot of homicides as a result or death. They should have a federal separate monitor. And also the cameras are good, because police just don't tell the truth in situations like this, and they shouldn't. Now, they had just had a video yesterday that was on television with the California Highway Patrol. It's a similar incident. A woman was talking on a cell phone while she was driving a car. The officers put the light on her, and she said she was looking for a safe place to turn off the road. When they got out the car, they took it. This was a white woman. They took this white woman and slammed her to the ground, kicked her in the stomach, and hog-tied her. But when they got to, when they made their report, it was nothing like this. But how they was found out, they had the camera on in the car. 12 police showed up on the scene, and they had hog-tied a woman and left her in the middle of the road for some time. And then when they took her in, they found out that she was pregnant and everything. They sued the California Highway Patrol, and the woman received $250,000. But the police in this incident lied about the whole incident, and the police are still on the job. So you can't, if a police does something like this and a person dies, first of all, even if you do swallow drugs, in my opinion, you could arrest a person on suspicion of swallowing drugs, take him into custody, and take him to a hospital and have his stomach pumped out or something like that so that you can get the drugs. Just because a person makes a small drug...
Ernest, we have a lot of callers. I need you to kind of focus in on a question for Bernstein.
Say this. I don't think a drug stop should... result in a death, because it's not such a big thing, drugs. It's not a death penalty. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Well, look, Ernest makes a very good point. Certainly, a drug stop should not result in a death. I mean, as I mentioned before, whenever someone dies in police custody, it is a tragedy, regardless of the circumstances, but not every tragedy warrants criminal prosecution. And that's really kind of the point I'm trying to make. I mean, we take our responsibility very seriously. And as I mentioned before, again, I take no pride in this.
Right.
But we've prosecuted any number of police officers for using excessive force. But when you have a situation like the tragic situation involving Mr. Anderson, when it's just one, you know, when the individual's ignoring police commands, he's trying to destroy contraband, and the officer, you know, picks him up, and it's just the one effort. I mean, it's not like there was a repeated beating.
No, but it was eight broken ribs and bruised lung.
Absolutely.
That's a lot of force.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It would take a lot for either one of us to have eight broken ribs and just a simple...
Right. Well, you have to take into account, you know, the location, the ground, the degree of force that was used, the amount of force that was used. And when you combine all of those factors under the law, and particularly when you consider the officer's training regarding the continuum of force, we made the decision. Now, you know, the other interesting point – not interesting but good point that Ernest makes is, you know, there are other mechanisms. you know, he thinks that the, you know, there should be some, as a general matter, that, you know, there could potentially be federal investigations and the like. And that's always an option. That's always something that the, you know, the federal government looks at in these kinds of cases. And where appropriate, they may conduct their own prosecutions.
410-319-8888. Frank, you're on the air. Frank, you're on the air?
Hello, yes, I'm here. My name is Shayna Anderson.
Oh, I'm sorry. It says Frank on my screen. Apologize. Shayna, go ahead.
I'm on the air?
You're on the air.
Oh, no. I was just calling to let Bernstein know that if he would have prosecuted the unit that killed my brother, maybe Tyrone West would still be alive today. And how do he feel about that now, knowing that the same group of cops murdered somebody else?
Well, Ms. Anderson, I want to send my deepest sympathies for the loss of your brother. You know, we've spoken before, of course. And as I was mentioning before, I think you have to look at each case differently and the circumstances under which they occurred. And I think that given the facts of the case involving Mr. Anderson, I know that you disagree respectfully, and I certainly appreciate your viewpoint, but I didn't believe, based on all the evidence and the witnesses that we talked to, that it warranted criminal prosecution. Now, with respect to Mr. West, as I was telling Mark earlier on the show, that is an ongoing investigation. We're actively involved in that as we speak, in terms of interviewing witnesses, trying to ascertain precisely what happened, getting the autopsy report completed, things of that nature. And so it really, I think, would not be appropriate to draw any kind of comparisons or conclusions until that investigation is completed.
And how long will that take, do you think, Tyrone West investigation?
You know, Mark, people ask me that all the time, of course, and it's a fair question. But I have to say that every case is different. And I can tell you, as we did with Mr. Anderson, we worked very quickly. We reached our conclusion within a matter of months, and we're doing everything we can with respect to Mr. West, to be very as thorough as we possibly can and complete, but yet at the same time resolve it as quickly as we can.
410-319-8888. Let's see. Hassan, you're on the air. Hassan, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for allowing me chime in and to your guest. You know, as the chair of the criminal justice for the NAACP, I think the biggest criticism we're hearing is this administration's inefficient prosecution. Promised a lot coming in 2010. A lot of people say he throws charges against the wall, hopes something sticks, and allows for the Tavon Whites of the world to build criminal empires over the city jail. But of over 20, even 30 officer-related shootings and apprehensions, that, and a lot of them turning into homicides over the past 3 years, you say you have prosecuted officers. I would like to know, name for you to name one case in an officer-related homicide of a citizen that your office has prosecuted.
So, Hassan, let me first of all, it's good to hear from you. So, you're asking me a case in which an officer had to use lethal force against the suspect and the person died, and have we prosecuted any officer who used such lethal force? And I think the answer is none. We've, based on our investigation of the number that have occurred, there's not been one that we felt, based on our investigation and the witnesses' statements and the forensic evidence, that warranted criminal prosecution.
Ellen Smith has written in, please ask Mr. Bernstein about the Anthony Black murder case. The young man stabbed outside the Cheesecake Factory back in April. Suspect Matthew Darby charged. Trial date set. Additional names released. Why no press?
Ms. Smith, I believe that case is resolved. I believe it's not. Oh, it's still pending. Okay, so I guess that. I mean, Ms. Smith, I do of course recall the incident in which the individual was stabbed to death. I thought that it was concluded, but I guess it's not. So it's probably. So I guess there's still a trial date pending. If you want, and I would say, Ms. Smith, as I would say to all the listeners, that if anyone has a specific question about any particular case in terms of result, trial date, status, things of that nature, that you should not hesitate to contact our office and our communications division and our community affairs department. We field those calls daily from citizens all over the city and provide information. So, Ms. Smith, to the extent that you have any interest or questions about that particular case involving Mr. Black, please don't hesitate to contact us, and we'll be happy to give you all that information.
A tweet came in. A tweet says, "The first, let's back to the lease. The first 3 years of the lease is split between state and city. Next 7 years is on the city's dime. $1.1 million a year times 10 years is $11 million, is what the tweet says.
Yeah, I don't know that that's entirely accurate.
410-319-8888. Bonnie, you're on the air. Bonnie, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
My name is Bonnie Bemore Advocate Lane, and I would like to ask Bernstein how he sleeps at night letting these cops who murdered Anthony Anderson also loose so they could murder Tyrone West. I also would like to petition for his immediate dismissal and recall from office. He has not locked up one cop in Baltimore City that has murdered anybody this year. And I also have a problem with the fact that the only people being killed by these police seem to be African American. I have a problem with that. I think he has a war on African American men of color in Baltimore. And I'm fed up with it, and I'm tired of his excuses, and I'm tired of his lies, and I want Baltimore City to do something for these victims of police brutality, not sweep it under the rug, and not give us a bunch of bulls.
Okay, so, Ms. Moore, I appreciate your comment. I would, of course, take issue with your comment that we try to sweep these cases under the rug. We actually are very transparent with the results of all our investigations, and you know, it's my obligation to apply the law to the facts and reach what I believe is the appropriate conclusions.
A lot of tweets coming in here. This is a tweet from Strand, who says, I don't know anything about this. Maybe you do. Nelson Clifford is set to go to trial next month for the most recent rape he committed. Are they going to win? And then he or she retweeted in, please have the state's attorney address Nelson Clifford. This guy has beat three rape charges.
He has, and we're not very happy about that. We believe that this is a person that should be prosecuted. We think that he is a dangerous individual.
Sounds like it.
That's our judgment. I mean, I don't want to get too much into the particulars because there's still one more case pending. All I can say is that we have tried extremely hard to successfully prosecute him, and we're hopeful that we will be successful in the next case.
Can you talk about what I read about this, why it's been so difficult to convict him? Is it no witnesses? Is it people
trying
to testify?
No. You know, of course, sexual assault cases are very different from the violent cases. Well, I mean, sexual assault cases, of course, are violent, but in terms of shootings and murders and things of that nature, in that you have a victim who comes forward and testifies. But what's happened in the previous cases is that Mr. Clifford has testified that the sexual contact was consensual, and the jury accepted his version of what occurred.
So you're trying him one more time here.
Yes, sir, we are, and we're hopeful we're going to be successful.
Quick thought from Terry in Baltimore. Terry, you're on the air. Terry, you're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I thought in the handling of the situation with the Park Heights with the young man of the community patrol was wrong. Had that been reversed, where there was a black individual who had beaten up the white person, the charges would have been totally different. So, Mr. Bernstein, I really don't care for you.
All right.
Well, Terry, you know, what I would say about the Wertesheim case, which, you know, it's now been some 3 years, is that it's important for all the listeners to recognize that the one brother that was charged before I even became state's attorney. After I became state's attorney, I was the one that pushed the investigation to charge the other brother. So we went to trial with respect to both of them, and we were successful in convicting the one of assault, notwithstanding some real challenges in that case. So I do feel very strongly that you know, we proceeded with those cases. We prosecuted them. We did the best we could to convict the people that assaulted the young man, and we were successful at least with the one brother.
Greg Bernstein is Baltimore City State's attorney. Once again, thank you for coming in and being so willing to talk to the public.
Always happy to come on, Mark. Great to see you.
Thanks, Greg. We're going to take a brief break. Then we look at sound bites. Don't go away.